system of social inequality. The system of gender inequality needs to be seen through two additional lenses. Lens one is, again, the individual civilization. All the classical civilizations were patriarchal, but not all of them were patriarchal in the same way. Probably the starkest statements of patriarchy, at least on the surface, came from classical China, where Confucian culture was actively used to describe appropriate family relationships. The argument was that the family should be the mirror of society at large, that as the emperor was in society at large, so the older father was in the family, and women as a subordinate group were supposed to be productive, deferential, just as the lower classes were in the larger social order. And the Confucian culture generated a host of stories and actual gender manuals that illustrated these directives. The most famous manual produced by a woman in the Han Dynasty, Ban Zhao, the most famous manual was reprinted many times from the classical period right on up to the later 19th century, and it described, at least superficially, a starkly patriarchal world. When a girl was born, she should be placed at the foot of the bed. When a boy was born, at the side of the bed, so that in growing up, they would immediately know their different places in relation to their beloved parents. Girls should learn domestic tasks. Wives should be deferential to husbands. They owed husbands decorous behavior, efficient management of the household, and deference. This was a world of two spheres, and the female sphere unquestionably unequal. Indian patriarchy was in some ways just as strict. Hindu legalists, for example, argued whether if a woman lived up to her obligations in this life and was able to come back spiritually advanced, her next step would have to be being a man. Some of them argued the man would be the next step. Some of them argued that women could advance spiritually without going through that gender transformation. But the fact that you could have even the argument was itself revealing. But the Indian version of patriarchy was probably a little bit more supple than the Chinese, again, at least on paper. Indians valued female beauty more evidently than did the Chinese. They were more interested in vigorous representations of women in art. Hindu stories were more likely to describe successful initiative by women, initiatives undertaken in the name of fathers or husbands. It's patriarchal. But the fact is, women could be clever. They could outwit the gods even on occasion. They were operating in a situation where they might earn greater praise. And informally, it's been argued that the attention heaped on women, for example, when they were about to give birth, the attention heaped on women on the occasion of weddings was simply provided a different ritual atmosphere for the operation of patriarchy in the Indian case. Classical Mediterranean, frankly, a little varied. Classical Greece exercised almost as strict a control over women as did classical China. Aristotle was eager to urge men to treat inferior women as nicely as they possibly could, the implication being that, you know, it's really sort of hard because they are so laggard. Upper-class women were confined to household. Rome, particularly in the late Republican, early Imperial period, Rome was somewhat more lenient, and women had more protections in law of the major cases. It was probably the case in which the patriarchal strictures, at least for a few centuries, were least severe. So, the classical civilizations had, within the framework of patriarchy, distinctive gender signatures, just as they had distinctive signatures with regard to social systems. The second question to ask of gender is the same that we will conduct with regard to social classes. How could women put up with this? There are several answers. First of all, patriarchy itself obviously tended to isolate small groups of women in separate households. So although they might see each other on festival occasions or sometimes in the marketplace, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for large groups of women to get together to compare notes. And of course, as with the lower classes in the social system, they were themselves victims of the dominant culture. They were told they were inferior. And doubtless many of them internalized this and had no basis for thinking about potential options. But there are a couple of other features that are worth noting in talking about how this system could generate a little bit more flexibility than it might seem possible on paper. Obviously, in the first place, there are personality variants. Individual women could be forceful within the patriarchal system, either to be more successfully expressive or to be just plain nasty. Socrates' wife, Xantippe, for example, was supposed to be just a horrible person, which is one of the reasons he spent so much time in the marketplace with young men, because his home life was dreadful. Aban Zhao, the manual writer in classical China, although she wrote about how women were supposed to measure up to the patriarchal system, was herself an educated upper-class woman, accomplished, capable of advising emperors. Individual situations could break the patriarchal mold, both at the level of ordinary people and at the level of elites. Class was also important, and this is a tricky one. On the whole, the patriarchal strictures about how women are inferior to men operated with greatest force in the upper classes. Lower class situations, where women's work was essential, where women had to help on the farm or in the household or with the craft, there was inequality here too, but it was much less marked because both parties, men and women, knew that both parties were essential to the economic survival of the family. So the groups where patriarchal inequality was fiercest had the compensation of being in the upper class, which maybe made the whole situation more endurable. But the two crucial points about surviving the system are, first, that although women were inferior in the patriarchal system, they were not, at least supposed to be, the outright property of men. Patriarchy in this sense is a little tricky. And on closer examination, a treatise like Ban Zhao's Manual for Women turns out not just to emphasize that women were inferior, etc., which was true, but also to emphasize that men in the best Confucian upper-class tradition owed their inferior wives and daughters something in return for production and deference. So men needed to treat women decently without too much overt cruelty. They needed to provide appropriate education, at least in household skills. And if they didn't do this, they weren't living up to the upper side of the mutual obligation systems that described Confucianism. Finally, in all the patriarchal systems, although, again, women were inferior, there was a certain possible leeway over time. The most powerful woman in a patriarchal family structure, and this was very clear in the Confucian system, the most powerful woman was an older woman who had had sons, whose husband had died, and who was able to retain a stature as mother of sons without being encumbered by an actual husband boss, whose daughters-in-law would be brought home by the sons to be governed by their mother-in-law. In other words, although this wasn't exactly a social system of mobility, there was a family system of mobility that, if you were lucky and survived enough, you could actually hope to enjoy. Another explanation of why the system worked a little bit differently from the way it initially looks on paper. All right. Now the challenge. So what? I hope I've argued that each of the classical civilizations had a somewhat distinctive social signature around a common commitment to inequality in social class and gender, so that one can add caste system to Hinduism and Buddhism as features of classical India. I hope I've also successfully argued that the systems need to be looked at a little beneath the surface to understand how they actually operated, even though they still add up to a system of inequality, somewhat different at least, certainly somewhat more unreflectively rigorous than we're accustomed to in modern times. What does it all matter? All right, let me offer a few illustrations. The first one is tentative, but it has been argued, and I think it's an interesting point, it has been argued that different versions of patriarchy could produce different male behavior, particularly that the way the system operated in China where mothers had every reason to develop particular attachments to their sons, particularly if they were second or third wives in a polygamous family, that men developed a sense of devotion, a psychological link with their mothers that was simply greater than developed in the classical Mediterranean, where households were a little more varied, where there were other people caring for children besides the mother. Now, this is tentative. This is tentative. But I will add one of my favorite images from classical China, which is the mother of one of the Confucian philosophers beating him with a cane, an older woman, obviously, beating him with a cane in order to make him obedient. And his reaction was, "I hope she's not hurting herself." Okay? Gender systems could vary enough to matter. The importance of different social systems is even more obvious, and I want to offer two illustrations definitely, and then a third that we'll return to a couple of sessions hence. Illustration number one. We all know, I've mentioned it before, it deserves renewed attention. We all know that the technological levels of, say, classical China and the classical Mediterranean differed considerably. The classical Mediterranean was terrific in civil engineering and the construction of great monuments, probably the best of the most successful of the classical civilizations in this regard. Classical China, however, had it all over the classical Mediterranean in terms of practical technological innovations in the area of production. It was classical China that introduced paper, classical China that invented the wheelbarrow, classical China that introduced some of the basic innovations in windmills that produced greater productive power, etc. All right, why? Why? Well, maybe a little bit has to do with government. The Chinese government was more interventionist than that of the Mediterranean and actually invested in what we would currently call research and development. Possibly a little bit culture. Classical Mediterranean view of science argued that scientists were supposed to develop visions of the rational universe and that dealing with petty practicalities was beneath them. And there are explicit quotes to that effect among Hellenistic scientists, for example. But the most obvious explanation for technological difference is that when China wanted to improve productivity, their most obvious recourse was to try to think of a new technological device that would do exactly that. When landowners in the classical Mediterranean wanted to advance a productive system, their most obvious recourse was to try to acquire more slaves. Slave systems are not absolutely immune to technological improvement, but they tend to discourage it, and that seems definitely true here. The social system mattered. It helps explain different production arrangements, different technological experiences, and even, as we'll argue next time, to some extent, different foreign policies. Second illustration. It would be nice to say that we had a definite sense of rates of social protest in the three societies. Information is simply not extensive enough for us to claim that. But it is certainly likely that, on the basis of the records we do have, plus speculation, that the classical civilization that faced the greatest amount of social protest, recurrently, not all the time, but recurrently, was actually classical China. The civilization that probably faced the least was classical India, classical Mediterranean, a little bit in between. Why? Classical China obviously nested social inequality, the inferiority of the ordinary working peasant, nested social inequality in a Confucian culture that insisted that while hierarchy was great, it had to be leavened by reciprocal benefits. Okay. Insofar as peasants bought into this system, insofar as they adopted some Confucian values, they could easily see that, on occasion, landlords weren't living up to their side of the bargain. They were exploiting labor too greatly. They were not providing enough material protections. So the inequality system, combined with the cultural system, could produce recurrent situations of unrest in which the peasants thought they were actually doing what their value system told them was legitimate. Classical India, with the caste system, reinforced the caste system with this sense of religious rewards and sanctions. it was much easier to assume that if you simply lived through your caste obligation in this life, there would be a clear payoff later on, something that was not present in the Chinese value system to the same extent. And classical India also, as we've previously argued, used the caste system to keep social groups partially separate so they didn't rub against each other as directly as landlords and peasants might occasionally in China. As I say, classical Mediterranean, probably a little bit in between. We have images of slave protest in the classical Mediterranean world. Spartacus was a great old movie, but it actually was quite uncommon because actually slavery was not all that onerous for many of the people that participated in it. Again, specific social system matters. And finally, though, this is something we'll take up a couple of sessions hence. Social system might also matter, or social cultural system might also matter, in terms of the kinds of attachments ordinary people developed to their society and their social order. Some systems probably worked better than others, and when times got bad, that could show in different results as well. The legacy of the classical social systems was both specific and general. Specifically, India still grapples with remnants of the caste system, even though it's been outlawed for over half a century. Elements of Confucian social thinking still mark the Chinese experience. Slave thinking, slavery systems are officially gone, but the influence of classical thinking about slavery certainly marked history at least up till about a century ago. And obviously, some of the assumptions and systems involved in patriarchy, although presumably now eroding, continued to be influential as well. There's a legacy here, just as there is in the cultural systems we talked about last time. And finally, there's a larger legacy that we continue to grapple with, and that is the extent to which inequality was assumed, deeply ingrained, embedded in economic inequality, embedded in inequalities in access to literacy, embedded in different political rights. Although we're a very different society today, arguably we're still dealing with that heritage as well.
Lecture 7. The Roman Empire and Han China.
This session talks about the comparison between the Roman Empire and the Empire of the Han Dynasty in China. The purpose is severalfold. First of all, quite simply, it's a terrific comparative opportunity. As I'll illustrate further in just a moment, these two societies for a several century span were remarkably similar in some basic achievements, and that gives us an opportunity to look more closely at how classical societies operated, how classical politics could operate, in a context in which you're comparing apples with apples for the most part. Second purpose related to this, obviously, is to use a slightly more leisurely, focused comparison to get a better sense of what classical governments could do. The focus this time is not just on politics, but the government aspect will be central. Final focus is to make it clear, in the case that it's still necessary, that a world history approach to the classical period needs to be very certain that our interest in Greece and Rome, in this case Rome, is properly balanced by an understanding of the important things occurring in other parts of the world. This lecture does not depend on a sense that Rome was somehow inferior to Han China. It was slightly different. But it does insist that the world of the classical period was not one in which Rome just sat there with a few isolated societies on the boundaries. I recently heard that reasserted, that Rome controlled the whole world. Well, it didn't. We shouldn't think so, and it's a distortion of world history even to pretend that that was the case. It won't surprise you at this point to know that this comparison will be a little bit, to take the terms of one of the societies we're looking at, a little bit yin and yang. We'll be talking about a lot of really interesting similarities and overlaps, but I want to focus particularly in the second part of the exercise in some revealing differences or shadings as well. Not surprisingly, the end result is two societies remarkably alike, but not exactly alike, and the differences may have counted not just at the time, but subsequently as well. One final preliminary. The focus is on two empires. We don't want to forget that these empires did not exist through the whole classical period. And we don't want to forget that there were other significant classical societies as well. The similarities between the Roman Empire and the Han Empire remind us that the Indian experience was on the whole rather different. There were imperial periods. They shouldn't be forgotten. But the core of Indian history in the classical period rests on cultural developments, on social systems, to some extent on trade outreach, not nearly so clearly on political achievement. We could also work in the Persian Empire, which was a major political achievement for several centuries, and that would be a perfectly valid comparison, simply not exercised here because it's in a somewhat different chronological slot, and again, simply for reasons of feasibility. All right. Similarities first off. Classical Rome began its empire in 27 BCE, and the empire in the West definitively collapsed in 476. The Han Dynasty lasted from 202 BCE to 220 CE. So the Han Dynasty lasted for 418 years, the Roman Empire for 503. Remarkably similar. I don't know that it means too much, but it's an interesting start. As you know already, these two empires developed very similar territorial expansions. Rome's was more geographically dispersed because the Mediterranean sat in the middle. Han China was a landmass and therefore more compact, but the actual land territory controlled was remarkably similar, so that just as people refer to the Pax Romana in the Mediterranean world, the Roman peace, so one can refer to the Chinese peace, Pax Sinaica, in the Asian world under Han control. Both involve considerable masses of territory ruled on the whole in orderly fashion for a considerable period of time. As has been mentioned before also, the population levels of the two cases remarkably similar. Both had over 50 million people. Han China a little larger, but, you know, what's a couple million people among friends? Very similar operation in this regard. Both clearly had emphasized territorial expansion. Both prior to the advent of these particular regimes, Republican Rome had begun the expansionist process for Rome, which the empire simply took over and furthered. Earlier dynasties in China had also set the stage for the Han conquests in somewhat similar fashion. With expansion came, and we've discussed this before, came somewhat similar needs for integration. Both empires, again continuing work by predecessors, both empires worked hard on economic integration. The Han continued the policy of building road systems and canal systems so that the different major parts of the empire could be linked, allowing specialization and trade among the major regions. Rome, again continuing policies that had developed earlier in the Mediterranean, worked very hard on developing granaries in appropriate parts of the empire in Sicily and North Africa and elsewhere that it could then reach through Mediterranean trade routes with goods that would come from other portions of the empire, including Rome itself. Economic integration, the regulation and encouragement of merchant activity was fundamental to the prosperity, including the tax base, of both of these important political systems. Both systems worked on political integration directly. Slightly different mechanisms, but directly. In the case of Han China, several devices combined to try to produce a coherent political structure capable of ruling an empire that was so large that it could take over a month to reach the frontiers from the capital city, even with the fairly efficient road system that the emperors built. Efforts at political integration included, obviously, ideological promotion. The Han Dynasty attempted to further Confucian thought as the means of inculcating values in the elite and possibly beyond. That would emphasize loyalty, deference, devotion to the state, attachment to political order as represented by the Han emperors themselves. The emperors continued a tradition, along with Confucian values, of emphasizing their divine majesty, or at least semi-divine majesty. The concept of Son of Heaven was one that had been inherited and was still used sort of as a supplement to Confucian teachings, and there was no inherent contradiction involved. The emperors surrounded themselves also with great pomp and ceremony, constructing cultural monuments, military processions, parades, various activities that would demonstrate, at least to the urban populations, their splendor and their remoteness. And finally, and most crucial to the political cement developed by the Han introduced the first clearly established system of Chinese bureaucracy in which the central government would designate a significant number of people as governmental representatives in the provinces, representing the interests of the central government, receiving communications and sending information from and sending communications to the central government. The bureaucratic system was furthered by an emphasis on Confucian education and training in the literary classics, by the beginnings of an examination system that would, in principle at least, select bureaucrats on the basis of demonstrated merit. This bureaucratic system provided a network of political activities, political control, that helped bring this vast territory together in effective fashion. Again, Rome's methods were not exactly the same. The Romans did not have quite the same cultural apparatus as Confucianism provided, although lots of writers, particularly early in the empire, were eager to sing the praises of the emperors and the imperial system. So there was a sort of cultural panegyric developed early on that would help bring loyalty and attention to the new regime. A bureaucracy was developed. But it's obviously important to note that the Roman bureaucracy was somewhat more rudimentary than the Chinese, and the Romans placed more emphasis on the legal system and on the rule of law across the empire, at least as applied to Roman citizens. And this emphasis on common legal principles codified into really admirable statements of legal reality, this provided something of the same cement that the more abundant Chinese bureaucracy provided in that case. Rome, for the most part, did not emphasize the divinity of the emperors themselves, although patronage by the gods was part of the process and imperial participation in religious ceremonies part of the process as well. But the Romans certainly at least equaled, probably surpassed, the Han in imperial monuments, in processions through the city of Rome itself and elsewhere after military triumphs. The emphasis on the majesty, power of the imperial office was, if slightly differently expressed, clearly as great in Rome as in Han China. Both systems, again, probably differences in degree, but both systems also expanded the functions of government itself. I've mentioned in a previous comment the role of the Chinese government in patronizing a certain amount of scientific and technological research. This probably did not occur in Rome, but both governments, quite understandably, used their considerable powers of bureaucracy and taxation to pay a great deal of specific attention to the provisioning of major cities, in the case of Rome, particularly Rome, so that regulations and encouragement would help organize convoys of grain, would help set prices, would help regulate supply. The system didn't always work perfectly well, but on the whole, both governments were actively engaged in at least a certain level of economic activity designed in assuring the economic essentials of a stable social and political order. The Roman government was probably, in its imperial heyday, a bit